together and meditating together. So happy that Spirit Rock has opened its physical doors as well as its virtual doors. So, because it makes a difference coming together as a sangha, as a community. We are social animals, you know. We feel, we co-regulate each other. And so coming together in person or online, I won't include you all the time virtually, but there's something very lovely about being able to gather that we so lacked for a few years, you know. So makes me happy. That's it. We can go home now. We could just hang out and have tea. That would be fine by me. But we can also do some practice, some meditation together, and some reflection. So I'm just recently, I was at Esalen teaching this weekend on a theme of mine that I teach on sort of periodically, on the inner critic. And so I thought, well, that's pretty fresh in my mind. My critic is fresh in my mind. I may as well talk about the critic, because maybe the critic is fresh in your mind. I don't know. How many people who feel like the presence of the critic is sort of here, you know, online too? You can wave your hands if you feel like your critic is here, right? In some way, shape, or form. It's not true for everybody, and the critic comes in many forms and guises and has different kinds of impact. But I'd say for most people, it's worth giving that part of our mind, our being, some attention. So, and it just as much follows us into the meditation hall, to our meditation, to our spiritual practice, to our mindfulness practice, as it does follow, it can follow us anywhere. And so as we meditate together, I'm going to invite you to just keep half an eye out for how you're commenting, reviewing, evaluating, judging your experience, yourself, your meditation, your attention, your concentration, or whatever else it might have something to say about. Because it usually has quite a lot to say about a lot of different things. And with the practice of awareness, mindfulness that we do here, then that gift of attention is what allows us to see, to know, and to know the presence or the absence of anything, including thought, including the critic. So let's sit together. So sitting comfortably, sitting upright, whatever you need to find ease in your body sitting, and if you're at home, whatever supports brightness, uprightness, but also ease and embodied presence. And taking some moments to settle into stillness, attuning to stillness in the room, stillness of the night, stillness of the ground, the earth. The stillness of awareness. And as we assume this meditation posture, inviting an attitude of receptivity, openness, curiosity. What is present? What is here in the field of your experience? So I want to invite openness to the space in which we're sitting, this beautiful Dharma hall, spacious, feeling this space all around you, above you, below you, behind you, to the sides, to the front. And that space, spaciousness, is also reflective of awareness itself that's here, spacious, open. And like space, awareness can accommodate all experience. So attuning to what's naturally being known. What are you naturally aware of in this moment? Space, sounds, silence, body, sensations, quality of energy in the body, the aliveness. Or whatever else is here, the movement of breath, flow of air. Maybe feeling the reverberation of the drive of conversation of your day. Echoes in the mind, memories, thoughts, echoing in the heart with moods, emotions that may still be felt from events of the day. I'm going to invite you into sitting today with an open awareness, simply present to moment experience as it arises. Choiceless awareness. Aware of whatever's most predominant now, this moment. Sounds, sensations, thoughts, feelings. Awareness itself. And within that field of open awareness, it may be that your attention is drawn to continuity of attention with a certain experience, with breath, with body. Or not. As we continue our meditation together in silence, just to include some awareness of the mind and its thoughts, and noticing the presence or absence of any flavor of critique, judgment. Noticing that, noticing any impact from that. And otherwise, just continuing to be present moment to moment to whatever arises in experience. What is being known in this moment? What is the quality of attention in which you're receiving and attending to experience? Is there any layer of mind overlaying experience with some judgment, criticism, rejection? In the last couple of minutes of the sitting, letting go of any striving or struggle, just simply relaxing into what's here, knowing what's here. Close with some words from a poem by Julia Fehrenbacher. I am making a home inside myself. Let's see if your meditation's like this. I am making a home inside myself, a shelter of kindness where everything is forgiven, everything allowed, a quiet patch of sunlight to stretch out without hurry, where all that has been banished and buried is welcome, spoken, listened to, released. a fiercely friendly place I can claim as my very own. I'm throwing arms open to the whole of myself, especially the fearful, fault-finding, falling apart, unfinished parts, knowing every seed and weed and drop of rain makes the soil richer. I'm making my home a home inside myself where grace blooms in grand and glorious abundance, a shelter of kindness that grows all the truest things. So, I always find an interesting time at the end of a sit, whether the mind begins to evaluate your practice. If I ask you, well, just review your meditation. Just what was the last 30 minutes like? Can you review that without the critic giving its 2 cents? Maybe, maybe not. So, all right, we'll take a break. And I think we need about 15 minutes for a break. Yep. So we'll come back at 10 after 8. And there's lots of cookies out there for those of you in person. I'm afraid there's no virtual cookies. You're going to have to go to your own larder to get those. Okay, see you in 15. Thanks. So back at 8:10 for those of you online. Welcome back, those of you in the virtual realm. So, those of you coming back, if you want to grab yourself a piece of paper and a pen for an exercise, we might do. Or you can use your phones, as long as you're not texting. Unless you're posting about this amazing event you're at that's so cool that everyone's having FOMO that they're not there at. I'm getting a phone call. That's just have my phone off. I remember I was teaching in Yucca Valley, which was a center that Spirit Rock used to rent before we had this lovely campus, and I was giving the Dharma talk, and I was a new teacher, so it was kind of a big deal. It was like, you know, 6 or 8 teachers and 150 people in the audience, and I'm sort of just starting my Dharma talk, and this phone rings. This must have been just when phones were, so like 12 years ago or something, when phones were just starting to come out. And everyone's looking around, and Jack opens his jacket. It's like, oh, it's Jack's phone. So how many of you, just curious, this is a book I wrote called Make Peace With Your Mind. I'm curious, how many people have seen that, or a few of you? How many people have heard me talk about the critic before? Probably some of you. Yeah, yeah. For those same people who raised their hand, how's the critic doing? Is it still around? Maybe. Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was thinking about this talk and thinking, the inner critic is fairly tenacious, fairly stubborn, just like many of our mental habits and tendencies and patterns. They don't dissolve overnight. They don't disappear just because we become aware of them. In fact, sometimes they get stronger. And I was thinking to myself, how long has my critic been around? How long has your critic been around? A little while. Okay, how many people feel like they have an inner critic? Just raise your hand. Is that a silly question? Most people, almost everybody. How many people experience suffering as a result of their critic and what it says to them? Some kind of pain, suffering. Let's do that again, just raise your hand. Look around. Oh, I'm not the only one. Look at that. I thought I was the only fool who listened to this crazy voice in my head that made me feel miserable. Oh, I'm actually in good company here. Seems like it's most people. These people look really like good people and healthy people and, you know, well-adjusted. And yet here we are admitting that we're all in some way affected by or afflicted by or, you know, impacted by this this really interesting tendency in the mind that's, you know, strong and often very painful and quite insidious at times, relentless at times, quite distorted at times. Came to the Buddha, you know, the Buddha and the night of his enlightenment, Mara shows up. Mara, the voice of personification of ignorance. And as the Buddha is sitting on the lotus throne, as it's called, sort of on the verge of awakening, to realizing his true nature, and the voice of Mara, of doubt, comes, of the critic. And what does Mara say to the Buddha? You probably know the story. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to awaken? All the amazing Buddhas of the past have awakened. Who are you? How dare you have the hubris to think that you too can enlighten? Sound familiar? Who do you think you are going to Spirit Rock meditating? You know. And the Buddha wisely didn't get involved in a debate, because, you know, if you probably had that experience when you start debating with your critic, you tend to lose. Or it doesn't go anywhere. And so the Buddha, in this mudra, the Bhumishpasya mudra, puts his hand to the earth and says, the earth is my witness. The earth is my witness. Which I love as a nature lover, that the Buddha is saying, the earth is my witness. It's just by sitting here being, in my words, a child of the earth. We all have inherent capacity to awaken. So, and then you'd think after the Buddha got enlightened, no more Mara, no more self-doubt, no more that voice. But the Mara showed up many, many times throughout the Buddha's ministry, telling all kinds of things like, you should rest, you should stop teaching, you should retire, you should this and that. And the Buddha would have it to be this sort of dialogue, and then at some point, the Buddha would say, I see you, Mara, I see you. I see you. As in awareness arises, oh, that's just the mind. That's a story. That's delusion. And so we can really, it's what we draw on in this practice is that knowing, oh, when the critic's arising, oh, I see you, Mara. I see you, voice of doubt, of shame, of criticism, of undermining, of whatever it might be, bullying. So what do you call your critic? What are your names for your critic? So I just mentioned one, to bully. What else? What do you call it? Or how do you experience the critic that would have a name? Nothing? Don't call anything? Okay. Predator? Pardon? The judger. Mm-hmm. Tyrant? Yeah, because it's tyrannical, can be. Yeah? What else? Shamer? Think about what it does. The doubter. The invader. Dad. Yeah. And the other version of that? Mom. I usually hear mom first before dad. Thanks for bringing dad in. The underminer, the killjoy, the bully, taskmaster. Did I say that already? My favorite is the itsy bitsy shitty committee, because it's not just one voice, it has many voices. You know, the boardroom, the inner boardroom, you know, the CFO, you know, giving you a hard time about how you manage your finances. The COO is, you know, complaining about how you manage your life, and on it goes, you know. So it's important that we understand that it's multifaceted, and it changes over time, and it changes depending on where we are. So, you know, when you walk into Spirit Rock, suddenly the Buddhist critic shows up. Not very mindful today. Three cookies. A little greedy today. That was a little unkind, that little remark. Not very kind today. Right? So it follows us around. Meditation, a little bit distracted today. So what's amazing is how powerful this part of our mind is, and how much it can undermine a sense of well-being and a sense of goodness and a sense of happiness, actually. As one of my teachers used to use this phrase, the thief of peace, the thief of peace. I'd call it a thief of self-worth. So it's important we get to know it, get to understand it, get to recognize it, learn how to work with it, and also to have a sense of humor about it, because it's kind of, it can be comical when we take a step back and see, actually listen to the things it says, you know, which I'll talk about as we go on. So important to know, just be mindful of the different ways that it manifests, and it has many. One is the most perhaps obvious is the perfectionist. Anybody got perfectionistic tendencies? Or they show up in certain things that you do. You have to do certain things just right, whatever that might be. Right? Like parenting. Good luck. You know, like meditating. Like being a perfect partner. Have you ever met a perfect parent? Perfect human being? Perfect? No, it's just an idea. It's an impossible ideal that we, you know, that the critic can crucify us with. So one of the things I think the critic, in its sort of essence, is saying, it's not okay to be how you are. It's not okay to look in the mirror and say that's okay. It's not okay to have mistakes, foibles, quirks, idiosyncrasies. Not okay to make mistakes. Like when I was teaching in Esalen this weekend, I showed up without my book on the inner critic. And the inner critic had something to say about that. I tried to show up with it. I couldn't find it. It had something else to say about that too. Why didn't I put my books away in an orderly manner? I don't know, but I don't. Fortunately, Spirit Rock had a spare copy, so I could get one. Yeah. Oh, the time I went backpacking and I just put my, I'd thrown all my stuff in the tumble dryer, including my rain gear, and I got on this very rainy backpack trip and realized putting wet, you know, the rainproof gear in the tumble dryer makes it not very rainproof. My critic had a few things to say about that. So it acts as the reminder, as if we didn't need it already, that you're not doing it right. You're not doing it right. You're not doing your meditation right. Oh, and another story about this book. So when I was writing this book, I was explicitly clear to myself it's going to be a thin book, because I wanted it to, because if I see a big, thick book, like the size, thickness of this, I'm not sure if you're those of you online, I'm not going to read it. It's like too much. I'm never going to start. But if it's thin, I'm like, oh, I can give that one a go. So, but when it came, when it arrived from the publisher, you know, from the manuscript into like the book form, the first thought my mind said was, it's a little thin. It's not thick enough. It's not substantive enough, which means it's lightweight, blah, blah, blah. It was hilarious. You've got to laugh. You can't win. So the critic has 20/20 hindsight, as do we, but the critic uses that. We'll look back on our past, on decisions, on experiences, but particularly decisions. And, you know, it's easy from this point of view to say, well, you know, I shouldn't have invested in Palm Pilot back in 2001, you know, or I shouldn't have, you know, dated that person that turned out to be very, very, you know, difficult, or, you know, any number of decisions. It's easy to do that from here. But in the moment, this is, I think, is a really important point. In the moment, we do the best we can with the information and the resources and the conditioning that we have. Always. You might not believe that. You don't have to believe that. But I do believe it's true, that we always do the best we can in the moment. And for the critic, that's not usually up to snuff. It's not usually good enough. So one common experience I have here is you probably have this driving south like I did to Big Sur, and you got a choice south of San Francisco. You go the 280 or the 101, 280 or 101, you know, and it's a toss-up. And, you know, Google Maps and Waze help sometimes, and then, you know, but there's could be a crash, you know. And inevitably, if I hit traffic, guess what the critic says? You should have gone the other way. Why didn't you? You should. How could I know? You do the best you can, and then life happens, shit happens. So sometimes the critic shows up as kind of like a coaching voice. You know that voice, like the meditation coach, life coach, that sort of seems like it has your back, praising the way you do things. But shifts very quickly when things don't go so well, you know. So I like a lot of spontaneity. I like to be spontaneous when I'm teaching and other things, and sometimes that goes well, and then sometimes my critic is, you really need to be more prepared, because sometimes it doesn't go well, you know. So it can praise the spontaneity and then nail me for the lack of preparation. Or I love to hike alone, so I hike alone. It's like, yeah, hike alone, it's good for you to walk alone in nature. And then when I'm halfway in the hike, my critic will say, how come you never hike with other people? Like, what's up with you? Weirdo. No. So, but the sum of all these voices, I think, that they kind of distill down to basically this fundamental premise is, you're not enough. You're not enough. You're not doing it right. You're not good enough, not worthy enough. You could be doing better. I call it the tyranny of insufficiency. The tyranny of insufficiency. That's one of the fruits of listen to this critic is we're left with that who we are is not enough in some way, shape, or form. My life, my work, my body, my mind, my relationships, my finances, whatever it is, not enough. And then we look at our volumes of books on our bookshelf of self-improvement, self-help, you know, the 10 steps to this and the 20 ways to do that and the 30 things to let go of, and, you know, most of them get unread, you know. So not enough. So just notice for yourself, if that's a mantra for you, because it can feel like a mantra, ways that you're not enough in yourself, for somebody else, in your work, in your meditation. One of the sort of odd ways that it shows up in the insufficiency is, and I see this a lot in working with people in this kind of circles, is I should be further along on my path. I should be a further along in my spiritual life, my spiritual development. I should be deeper in my meditation. Good luck. You're not. I mean, you are where you are. And to say you should be further along is actually nonsensical. It's not reality, right? It's a nice idea. It'd be nice to be more whatever you think it is, evolved or spiritual or, you know. But to put that on oneself is really sort of cruel, because it's saying you should be something different than you are. And you can only be how you and who you are. Right? Do you see the sort of the paradox of that? So the tyranny of not enough. Tyranny of not enough. And then we have parenting. Right? How many people feel like they're doing a great job of parenting? Hopefully it's good enough. Right? We go from not enough to good enough. That's one of my mantras, good enough. This is from Annie Lamott. She says, "I'm probably just as good a mother as the next repressed, obsessive, compulsive, paranoiac." So think about your life and all the different things you do, and where your critic shows up. And it can kind of show up anywhere. You get up in the morning, "Oh, my house is a mess. I'm not a good enough housekeeper." You get to the kitchen, and you don't make, you go for whatever it is, I don't know what you eat, and it's like, "Oh, that's not enough." And then your coffee's not good enough. And then you get to work, and then that's not good enough. And then you go to the gym, and it's like, "Well, God, I'm really not good enough there." And then on it goes, you know. So what I think's more important than that distillation of the sense of lack, deficiency, is that the result of the fruit of that, of all these judgments and criticisms, is it's not that the criticism in and of itself is such a big deal, but the accumulation and the implication of the judgment is. So, for example, say you're someone who's always late. Anybody here late a lot? I cut it fine. I'm late fairly frequently, including here sometimes. And if you're late, and the critics say, "Oh, you're late again. You're always late. You're always late." It's not just that you're always late. You're always late. Therefore, this means something about you. This means that you're less than in some way, that you're deficient in some way. So the fruit of self-judgment is it leads to shame and unworthiness. Shame and unworthiness and deficiency, which is such a bundle of joy. I'm so happy I'm talking about this tonight, because it really is a jolly topic. So think about it. Think about when you're criticizing yourself. You know, the actual thing, maybe you've got a very messy car, or maybe you're disorganized at your desk, and maybe you have ADHD like I do, and you frequently miss things and double book meetings and are late for things. And so each one of the things is sort of small in themselves, but every time the critic is on your case about it, the implication is, therefore, because of all of these things, you're less than, you're deficient, you're unworthy or worthless. And that sounds extreme when I say that, and I'm looking at some of your faces going, "I don't believe that." But it does impact our well-being. And I think it's a leading cause of depression, personally. If you listen to a voice that's telling you you're, whatever it is, not smart enough, that you're incompetent or disorganized or lazy or, many, many worse things than that, what's the net fruit of that is we feel bad, we feel depressed. So, and it universalizes. So, from I'm late to you're always late. Someone's saying, maybe your partner or your kids or someone's saying, you don't listen to me, you're never really there for me. You weren't there for me in that conversation, and it will universalize. You never listen to people. Never listen to me. So, yeah. So just notice what's present for you as I'm talking. And notice both what feeling is here and what's happening in your mind in response to this. Because your critic might be saying, this is a load of, And when I talk about judgment, I want to be clear that there are many ways that we need to evaluate and assess and discern and discriminate in our lives. We often have decisions we need to evaluate. We need to someone evaluate someone's performance. We need to discern whether someone is right for a job or not, or some contractor we're hiring is the right person. Yeah, so all those kind of judgments are necessary. And I'm talking about a judgment that leads to has a negative emotional impact. And so this is a quote from Jeanine Roth, which she's pointing to why. Well, I'll just read it. She says, "It is very important for every human being." That's the wrong quote. You read the wrong thing. Let me show you. Do something else instead. All right. This is a drawing class, and the prompt at the drawing class was to draw your inner critic, which we might do later. So this person draws the inner critic, little thought bubble, and the thought bubble says, "You drew me all wrong. You drew me all wrong." Of course, how could you draw the inner critic right? You can't. You just can't get it right. So because we think the critic is true, or has is objective, then we listen to it. And this is why, when I teach about mindfulness, there's always two things going on. There's paying attention to what's happening and paying attention to how you relate to what's happening. So there's the judgment, the criticism, either the judgment itself or the critic as a sort of, whole, and how we relate to it. How do you relate to that voice? How do you relate to that judgment? Do you believe it? Do you accept it? Do you think it's true? Do you give it authority? Do you let it speak to you relentlessly as it may like to do? How do you relate to that voice? Because many, many thoughts, and there's thousands of thoughts going through our mind every day. And hopefully with mindfulness and awareness, we see, oh, it's just thought. It's just a subjective perception mostly. But because we believe the critic is true, we've listened to it since we were, 4 or 5 years old, we let the critic talk to us and barrage us and be relentless. And we become loyal to it, thinking we need it to get out of bed, to make a decision, to make an ethical choice, to get our shit together. And so by listening to it in that way, we give it a lot of authority and strength. So that's the preamble to Jeanine Roth's quote, which I will try and read correctly. Jeanine Roth. For some reason, we are truly convinced that if we criticize ourselves, the criticism will lead to change. If we are harsh, we believe we will end up being kind. If we shame ourselves, we believe we will end up loving ourselves. It has never been true, not for a moment, that shame leads to love. Only love leads to love. So I think this is a really important point because I know this experience very much in myself, and maybe you know this, that I have some experience, that my critic perceives as, wrong, bad, stupid, or whatever. And it will criticize me, sometimes vocally, vehemently, persistently, with the sort of sense that this will somehow make me not do it next time. Have that experience? Yeah, we all mess up. And then we give ourselves a hard time thinking that, well, if I just berate myself enough, that somehow will create constructive change in the future. But what does all that condemnation do? It just makes us feel collapsed, feel stupid, feel less than. It's not actually, you know, the research shows in when, you know, working in teams, for example, people work much more effectively with a constructive, positive, appreciative manager, see, than criticism. So the same applies to ourselves, that we don't grow when we're being yelled at. You know, we don't learn when we're being ridiculed. Because when the critic is on a case, I would say, I don't know if this has ever been measured, but you know, we're in a fight flight kind of state, and just as when someone challenges you or criticizes you, you know, it's a very aggravating experience. So we're not in a best place to understand, you know. Ideally, if we make a mistake or we hurt someone that we care about or we forget something or we, you know, something that we could have done better to listen and understand and pause and review that rather than berate ourselves. Okay, so I'd like you in this exercise, both in person here and online, you all have pieces of paper or a phone or something to write on. I would like you, and if you're at home, you can write whatever on your computer or a piece of paper, to write out your top five self-judgments. Your top five self-judgments. And then I'll open up my Facebook and we're going to post them on there. I'm going to take a screenshot of you and then, just kidding, we're not going to do that. And for some of you, they might come very easily, like top five, I've got 20. Okay, well, if don't stop at five if they're coming thick and strong. Sometimes we might think, oh, I've got a lot of judgments, and then actually when you come to write them out, it's like, oh, I actually don't. It might be about your body, about your life, about your work, about your finances, about your relationships, about your parenting. And then notice how you feel when you write these down. Notice how you might be mortified if you see your neighbor peering down at your sheet, because it's kind of embarrassing. Except if we collated them all, I bet there'd be like about 15 or 20 judgments that we all kind of share, all similar. Not smart enough. When are you going to get your life together? And then when you've written some out, a few, five or more, then just read them. Like, read them with as much of an objective mind. Try to make the judgments short. And then notice, is your judgment in the I language or the you language? So is the judgment, I am hopeless meditator, I am a terrible parent, or is it you are always failing, you're always irresponsible, unreliable, or untrustworthy, whatever. So notice if it's in the language of I or you. Just gonna do a poll. How many people are writing in the I am da 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 da? How many in the you? Okay, so a little more on the I. Okay. So for those of you who responded I, when you hear your critic talking to you, is it saying I or you? I. I'm so. Okay. All right. So my invitation to you is to practice saying you, not I, you. And it's kind of sounds maybe odd or subtle, but one of my sort of orientations about this work is we're trying to create space and awareness between ourselves and the critic, even though the critic is an internal voice. But just in the same way that mindfulness creates space with awareness to be able to say, see our thoughts, right? That the shifting from the I language to the you language, I think, is a way that you create a little more space. If I am really stupid, it's very internal. If it's you are really stupid, there's a sense of it's coming from something outside telling you. Does that make sense? And so I don't really know how you make that shift, to be honest, from I to you, except maybe just every time that you're judging yourself, oh God, I'm so incompetent. And you just remind yourself, oh, you're so incompetent. My critic is saying, you're so incompetent. Okay. Thank you, critic. Right? And so you could because you want to start creating some distance, So play with that. So in my critic workshops, which we don't have time to do today because we only have little time, the next thing I would have you do with these judgments, which you can do at home. And maybe some of you have already done this, is I'll draw on Byron Katie's work and have you ask three or four questions in relationship to each judgment. So if someone would be kind enough to shout out one of your judgments, it's like, I'm not enough, okay? So the judgments, I am not enough. So, and then I'd go through the four questions are, is it true? How can I know that it's true? What happens when you believe that thought, and who would you be without that belief? It's a paraphrase of her work. So I'd ask you, is it true that you're not enough? And maybe you might say, well, yeah, it's true. Okay. How can you know that it's true? Well, let me tell you the ways it's true. Okay. All right. Maybe you really believe that thought, or maybe, the judgment is, you're really, it's an always or never, you're never there for your kids. Well, is that actually true? I mean, these are the 17 ways that I'm present and show up for my kids. I might not be there as enough for them or for whoever. So is it true, kind of, and I know that's true, is you're questioning the objectivity of that statement. And then who would you be without that belief? So who would you be without that story, I'm not enough? I don't know, I've never had that experience. Well, if I didn't believe I wasn't enough and I actually feel like I'm enough, I'd feel a lot less painful. I'd feel a lot less miserable. I'm not saying you are, but one could with that belief, right? Oh, sorry, I got that the wrong round. The third question is, what happens when you believe that thought? When you believe that thought, yeah, I feel like shit. I feel like I'm not enough. I feel insufficient. I feel deficient. I feel unworthy. I feel unlovable, or whatever comes from that. Who would I be without that story? Oh, I don't know. It's such a radical thought. But maybe I'd be okay. You know, maybe I'd like myself. You know, maybe I would be kind to myself. Or maybe I'd, you know, give up all my subscriptions to all my self-help groups, you know, whatever it is. So you can play with those questions. You might want to write those down. You can look, her work is called The Work. Is it true? How can I know that it's true? What happens when you believe those thoughts, or what's the payoff for believing those thoughts? You know, makes me feel small. I feel safe when I put myself down. You know, I was always told as a child I was too big for my breeches. You know, be seen and not heard. Lovely English parenting style. So it keeps me small, so I'm safe. And then who would I be without that thought? So much to say. What I found with working with, so I've been a therapist and a coach and a Dharma teacher for a long time, and worked with the critic, worked with my own critic for a lifetime, and worked with people's critic for many years. And what's powerful is when we give this part of our psyche attention, which we often don't do. The reason I have you write them down, well, there's a few reasons. One is whenever something's just, you know, going around like a tumble dryer in the back of our mind, right? We often don't even know we have a critic. Most people, I'd say, don't know they have a critic. It's just my mind. My mind's a bit judgy, you know. Just, you know, I grew up in England, critical culture. Just what you are, you're just self-disparaging. That's normal sort of everyday parlance. How are you? I'm a piece of shit. How are you? Crap. Great. Good. I now relate to you. Okay. Good. My people. You know. In England, when someone says, "How are you?" You're like, "Oh, not bad. You know. Could be worse. You know." That's about as good as you'll get. You know, I came to California and it's like, "How are you?" "Oh, I'm fantastic. Oh, I'm just great today." I'm like, "Oh, that's a bit weird." Tone it down, please. Tone it down. It's too much light. You know, so we have our cultural conditioning, we have our family conditioning. I lost my train of thought where I was going with that. Why I make you write, right. So you write them down, you read them, it's a little more objective, especially when we read. Because in the tumble dryer of our mind, it's just murky thoughts. Write them down. Or is that really true that I'm unlovable or that I'm stupid? While I do have a master's degree, you know, I don't know if that means I'm not stupid, but, you know, a degree. You know, because, you know, the critic does universalize, and it's good to really be discerning. And then generally the next part of the exercise in a workshop is I'd have you turn to the person next to you, and I'd have you share your judgments to the person, preferably a complete stranger you'll never ever see again. not someone you brought on a date or something, you know. And then they share theirs with you. And then you realize, oh, we've got a bunch of similar ones. Oh, yeah, we both think we're stupid or not lovable or whatever, you know, the story is. And the sharing of them is another way of breaking the spell, right? Breaking the shame bubble, right? Because I'm sure, you know, when you're writing these down, that you'd be mortified if someone read them. You know, you're welcome to go home and flush them down the toilet or burn them, or you could actually go home and share them with a person who, you know, loves you, cares about you, and goes, "God, I can't believe that I never really looked at this. And these are some of the stories that are running around in my head. You know, it's kind of painful, sad." And the person who you're sharing them with, who knows you and loves you, will be like, "Those seem so distorted to me. So inaccurate, so misperceiving of who you are in your essence." So sometimes we need that feedback from other people because we can't see it ourselves. And sometimes it takes a long time to extricate ourselves from the grip of the critic, from the belief. It took me decades, I would say, you know. So then the next part of the work, which I'm only going to touch on a little bit, I usually do a critic workshop here every year at Spirit Rock. So I'll try and do one in the fall where we can unpack this a bit more for those who are interested. So the next part is, okay, so you've got your judgments. You've done some inquiry with them, named them, you've shared them if that's comfortable. And then you begin working with the critic in a more dynamic and active way. Or first passive, then active. And so the subtitle of the book, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Help Free You from the Critic. So there's two main sort of orientations. One is with awareness, right? And awareness, mindfulness is key, right? Without mindfulness, we don't know what's going on. We don't know what's happening in our mind. And so mindfulness is really helpful. So the homework that I give people is, like tonight or tomorrow, pay attention to your thoughts, as you might do anyway, but pay attention to every time you notice a judging thought about someone else, judging thought about yourself, judging thought about, you know, where you are, about the world. Just begin to notice when the critic is active, which is different than just, you know, oh, I like this room, you know, which you could call it judgment, but it could be a discernment. Oh, I'm noticing there's a lot of space in this room. There's a lot of interesting, you know, beams and light. And same with your meditation. Like, begin to notice, do you bring criticism to your meditation when you look in the mirror tonight? You know, I was in a hotel the other day, and they had one of those super magnifying mirrors, you know, like 20x or something. Like, just misery. Like, who invented that? Like, just, you know, I had no idea I had so many hairs growing out of my ears. Like, I don't need to know that, you know. So, and then Australia, you know, it's just, turn around. Always use, like, the, you know, minus magnification. So it's kind of fuzzy. Right, so we're bringing awareness to when the judgments are there, noticing how it feels when you hear a judgment. And that was a big shift in my practice, when normally we're allied with our judge. We're believing our judge. We believe it's true. We're on our case about something. But if we switch from being on our case about something to the one who's being, you know, attacked, basically, talked to harshly, meanly, disparagingly, it's painful. Like, if you gave any one of those judgments you just wrote down to a friend or a colleague, and you say, hey, just ping me, like, you know, once a day, just shoot me, tell me I'm shitty at my job, you know, just remind me of that every day, it would hurt, right? You wouldn't do that. And if they did that once, you'd say, okay, like, that's really hard to hear. That's really mean. That really hurts. Right? We wouldn't stand for it for a minute, hopefully, for the most part, if we've got any self-respect. But internally, we let the critic rip. And so when we start to feel the impact in our heart, it can shift your allegiance from it. So there's a whole bunch of strategies I'm not going to go into. I do want to talk about how to dialogue with the critic. So we can understand the critic in different ways. You know, we can look at our origin of how the critic, you know, basically it's part of our egoic development, as Freud pointed out, it's part of the superego structure that helped us navigate strong instinctual impulses, teaching us how to fit into a family cultural structure and had its place. And my sense of the critic, when I notice the critic arising, when it gets triggered, is it's because there's a perception or an experience of vulnerability which is really how we were as children. We come in profoundly vulnerable, and we have to somehow very quickly navigate how to manage social relationships with our parents and family and beyond in a way that maximizes our attachment and security and love. And shaming ourselves through the superego is one way to do that. Helpful at a certain age, not helpful when we're 20, 30, 40, 60, 80. And so when my critic is activated, like for example, so I used to teach here a lot on Monday nights when it was in person. And I'm one of those people, and probably because of my ADHD, I like to cut it fine. And now I kind of cruise in like 7:13, you know, starts at 7:15, you know. But, you know, the 101 going north is very unreliable, has a lot of traffic. So sometimes it was 7:17 or 7:18 or, you know, just like, ooh, I'm late. I don't want to be late for that class. So I get very stressed when I'm driving and it activates my critic. And then I listen and say, oh, what's happening with my dear friend, the critic? Oh, he's trying to protect me because to show up late for a class is really not okay. It's disrespectful. And people will think less of me if they think I don't care about this class and the teaching. And so it's on my case trying to get me to not do that so I won't do it again and put myself in that vulnerable situation. Does that make sense? So it's really important that we understand, oh, this, it's not as inherently vicious or nasty. It's an outdated mode of trying to help us navigate life and motivate us or protect us, but in a way that's very harsh. And so the medium of doing that basically sort of upends the message. So sometimes I'll ask the critic, so what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of for me? What are you afraid is going to happen if I'm late for this class? Oh, you'll be judged. You might be rejected. People will think less of you. Or people might be angry with you. Okay. So what are you trying to protect me from? From rejection. From social, you know, banishment, ridicule. And then I'll ask, is there another way that you can say that to me? Rather than like, you're so stupid for not leaving yourself enough time. I can't believe you did that. You did that last week, for God's sake. Get it together. That doesn't work, because it says that all the time. But is there another way you could say that? Well, I really care about you, and I care about you taking your work seriously, because you do love this work. And it'd be really good if we can plan better so you get there on time and more relaxed. Oh, I can hear that. That has some sense to it. So, and I'm just sort of sharing that as an example of really trying to understand what's underneath, what's the pain point, what's the fear, what's the vulnerability. Really, it's about vulnerability. You know, and often it comes down to the vulnerability that if I'm like this, if I don't take care of my body or whatever it is, I'm going to lose love. I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to be abandoned. It just runs so deeply in us. So, and then the other practice that I think is really key and certainly been key for me in my own journey is the practice of love. Kindness, of forgiveness, and all those, and self-compassion. It's a whole cluster of things. So the Buddha taught metta, mindful loving kindness, as a replacing practice, replacing an unwholesome state like hatred, in this case self-hatred with the judge, to kindness, self-kindness. So whenever I did this practice for years, I mean, I've done metta regularly for decades, you know, just wishing myself well, holding myself with kindness, loving myself. In the beginning, the first, you know, beginning, like first 10, 15, 10 years, it was just cold. It was just words. It didn't really land. But I kept at it. And over the years, that turning to myself with kindness and care and love began to outweigh the harshness of the critic. So whenever you hear the judge doing its thing, like, oh my God, whatever it's saying, give me a judgment. I'm so tired of my own. Give me a judgment. Give me a judgment. You're fat. You're a failure. You're a failure, and may I be happy. You're fat, and may I love myself as I am. You eat too much, and may I be free from suffering. And you're not likable, and may I love myself as I am. So you replace the judgment with something kind, with an aspiration or a wish or an actual something you do think is true. And you just do that for a few years. And I'm serious, like a few, this is like long-term work. I mean, I have worked with people where they literally, their critic evaporated after a few months of work. I mean, it was amazing to watch, but that's not true for most of us. It wasn't true for me. And maybe that's why I can teach this well, because I really have to do my work around it. And it's still, even after all this time, it still has a life and a voice, and sometimes surprises me, like, wow, you're really loud today. mostly I don't listen, mostly I can be kind, and mostly I can go, oh, this is painful to hear, ouch. So yeah, when I say a few years, I mean a few years. really, it takes years to be kind, to cultivate love, to cultivate self-acceptance. Years, sometimes decades, decades for me, really, if I'm really truthful, decades. But what else am I going to do? I'd rather start now, sow some good seeds of care and self-kindness and begin to doubt and diminish the strength of that voice, And hopefully you're quicker learners than me, it won't take so long. Okay, so let me just see if there's something I want to close with. A little poem to. Well, I'm going to read this. This is, since we've been talking about Byron Katie, I'll read a quote from one of her books. Is it A Thousand Names for Joy or 10,000 Names for Joy, something like that? Does that sound familiar? Wonderful book. And so she's in the kitchen, she's cooking, and then something happens. She says, just when I think that life is so good, and this, I'm reading this because this is someone who's free from self-judgment, as far as I can see. Just when I think that life is so good that it can't get any better, the phone rings and life gets better. I love that music. As I walk towards the phone, there's a knock at the door. Who could it be? I walk towards the door, filled with the given, the fragrance of the vegetables I've been chopping, the sound of the phone, and I've done nothing for any of it. But I trip and I fall over. The floor is so unfailingly there. I experience its texture, its security, its lack of complaint. In fact, the opposite, it gives its entire self to me. I feel its coolness as I lie on it. Obviously, it was time for a little nap, a little rest, a little rest. The floor accepts me unconditionally and holds me without impatience. As I get up, it doesn't say, come back, you're deserting me, you owe me, you didn't thank me enough, you're ungrateful. No, it's just like me, it does its job, it is what it is. The fist knocks, the phone rings, the salad waits, the floor lets go of me. Life is okay. So next time you trip over or drop a plate, or spill your coffee or whatever it is, that, oh, I guess it's time to see the coffee swirls on the floor and, look a bit closely at the grass and, look at the pattern in my shirt that's got ketchup on it. And so, and I meet people who, are quite free from the critic. And they're really noticeable. Have you noticed that? Have you seen? There's a lot of space. They're light. There's a lightness. There's an ease. My sister's kind of similar to that. And she'll do something. She'll make a mistake. She'll mess up. She'll just laugh. Oh, that's funny. I just forgot that thing again. And it's very easy, peaceful. So, and I really share this teaching because really to remind us that it's possible, right? It only takes a moment, right? The critic's going on about something and you just go, oh, hello, critic. Oh, good morning. Oh, thank you for your point of view. Thank you for your perspective, because it is just a point of view. It's a negative, distorted point of view, and it's a negative perspective, but it's a perspective. It's not true. Oh, thank you for your point of view. I'm going to get back to chopping the salad. Thank you very much. Get back to driving, even though I'm late. I'm going to enjoy the drive, because why not? Here I am. So, all right, friends. Thank you for your attention. I probably went on a fair amount. Come back if I do the critic workshop, which I probably will do some point later this year. The workshop that was mentioned earlier, a very related topic for those of you who have ADHD or ADHD type experience. You might not be diagnosed, but many, many people feel like they live with ADHD, which is a complete setup for the critic because of all the things that happen when you have ADHD, which is why I'm teaching about it next month. How do we meet living with ADHD or someone with ADHD with mindfulness and kindness and wisdom? Because it's equal amount of suffering to the critic. So come to that. And then this nature program I'm doing starting in March, April, May, June, it's a day long a month. We're just going to sit outside in the meadow, up in the woods. If you want to explore mindfulness in nature, it's a beautiful way to do that. So that's some things that I'm doing upcoming. So thank you. Be well. Thank you, people online. Good to see you. Take care. And be kind to yourself. Thanks.